Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 35 for February 2nd, 2010. I'm your host, Dominic Rabi, and with me today we have
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We have three stories as usual this week, covering whether file extensions can be trademarks, the appeal of the Boring family against Google in the Street View case, and finally Amazon's Kindle, Macmillan the publisher, and ebook pricing in the wake of the iPad. Let's start off with our first story about file extensions and trademarks. This story comes to us from the Northern District of California, where a court decided the case Autodesk v. Dassault Systems, and in its decisions, they spoke specifically about the file extension DWG, which Autodesk uses in its AutoCAD software, and basically stated that file extensions can't be trademarks. Autodesk was attempting to obtain a trademark for DWG and prevent competitors from using DWG in advertising, saying that DWG, since AutoCAD was the first software product to use that extension, they should be able to control how people use it, and whether or not it's being used with Autodesk's proprietary technology, or whether people are just trying to use their file format without their permission. Basically, the court said that a file extension is functional, and so you can't trademark it. It turned out this case actually settled 6 days later for an undisclosed amount, but we can still talk about the issues behind it because it's interesting in terms of trademark law. So I guess the first question to our esteemed panel is the court right in saying that that file extensions are purely functional and thus can't be trademarked?
Well, maybe. At least that's how I feel about it. For people that don't, or at least aren't familiar with file name extensions, the file name extension typically appears after the name of a file. It's usually a dot, like .exe or something like that, and it sort of indicates the formatting of the file, usually, or whether or not it belongs to some sort of proprietary format, like a third-party program, like, say, Microsoft Word for a .doc or a .docx, or whether it's some other type of document. So that said, there's two parts to the way that these things work. There's sort of a functional element to them in that the computer is using them, at least partially, to identify the type of the file. And it also serves as an indicator for the user, at least the human on the other end of the machine, to be able to look at the file and determine what kind of file it is. So I think the case itself was pretty interesting, but it seems like they probably got it right, because I guess it depends on how a computer is specifically looking at the type of file that was at issue. But for the most part, they seem to serve such a functional purpose, and the way that trademark law works is that you have protection over something that serves as an identifier of a good or the branding behind a good, but you do not get protection for things that also have functional purposes. And so for the file extension, it just had too much of a functional purpose in the way that the machine uses that little three-letter extension on it or four-letter extension in some cases, to figure out what type of the format is. So.
But what about something like a PDF, to take this in a different direction right now? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think it's possible to create a PDF without using some technology that's been licensed from Adobe. Is that correct? Or even if it's not correct, can we assume for a moment that that is correct?
I don't think it's correct, but let's go along with the assumption.
Okay, so if we're assuming that's correct, yes, the .pdf still tells the computer what to open it with, but if, Adobe has, if you have to have licensed something from Adobe in order to create a .pdf or to open a .pdf file, then wouldn't there also be this strong association where if I double-click on that, I expect Adobe to open it and it to work? And if it doesn't work because, the file's, was made by a different program that hadn't licensed it or hadn't licensed the technology, or if somebody was intentionally trying to, sully the name of the .pdf, wouldn't that be that kind of issue that trademark law is meant to protect against? We don't want these people coming in and making counterfeit PDFs and then having me get a bad impression of Adobe because of, the improper use or unlicensed use of the PDF file format and extension.
The court seemed to think that the file extension, the consumer doesn't even look at it because the file extension is mostly seen by the computer. So it seemed from the excerpts I read of the court's opinion, they felt that the extension is something that's transparent. It's not visible to the user, and it's only viewable by the computer, so they wouldn't associate the PDF. To take a step back, and the context this sort of arose is Autodesk's competitor. Autodesk makes AutoCAD software, which is used in three-dimensional design. And one of their competitors, SolidWorks, would use in their advertising materials that, hey, we read DWG, which is AutoCAD's format. And they would send out advertisements saying, DWG compatible, reads DWG. And Autodesk had a problem with this because they felt that DWG was their format. They had created it 20 years ago, 23 years ago, and they had been using it in their software. And here they have a competitor saying that they can read their file format and trying to steal their customers in that sense.
So, Ben, by the same line of thinking, though, I mean, at least traditionally in trademark law, they have not accepted functional uses in order to be eligible for trademark protection. And when you fall into that area of functionality, then you usually start talking about patent protection, not trademark protection. So, by the same token, you can get those exclusive rights under patent law, and effectively use those to exclude people from creating that type of software.
Yeah, and my hypothetical kind of had to assume that, because the PDF would have to be exclusive to Adobe somehow. You know, the creation of it would either have to be, you know, you'd either have to go through an Adobe product or go through a product licensed by Adobe. I think even to try to claim that type of trademark protection over the file extension. Otherwise, it doesn't actually indicate the source. It indicates purely function. I mean, like a .psd, I've got a few programs. That's a Photoshop document. I've got a few programs on my computer that can generate .psds. So, you know, Adobe wouldn't be able to claim a trademark in a .psd because other programs can make it. It doesn't tell you the source. It tells you just simply what programs can open it or what the type of data is.
Well, certainly an interesting argument either way. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it too carefully until you even said that right there about how a proprietary company who's creating some sort of third-party software in a computer might really be interested in using trademark protection to have more protection over who could use documents within their software or who could use files within their software. So it is a really good point. I'll have to concede that, and that might be reason enough in the future at some point to carve out some sort of exception to a functionality rule like this, but especially one that doesn't really seem to play such a vital role as it used to. I mean, it used to be that on an operating system like Windows, you would automatically see the file name extensions at the end of a file when you were looking at them on your desktop. I don't know what the status is now in the new Windows releases, whether or not they're hiding file extensions or not. But
it defaults to off.
It doesn't really surprise me because they're trying to take the complexity out of using a computer. So why confuse people with extensions? So maybe they've become less functional on the human side and more functional on the machine side. But by the same token, though, if they are defaulted to off, that might just be a stronger argument for why trademark protection shouldn't prevail here, because the functionality is all on the back end, and if it's not playing any role to the consumer itself, then you know, it would seem that there might be other legal avenues that a company could take to protect their products.
So what's interesting about this case, or go ahead, Ben.
I was going to say, Mac OS X also defaults to off. The default is that it doesn't show file extensions.
What's interesting about this case is the bit about the file extension sort of arose in a hearing on the motion, which basically the judge was talking to the counsels for both parties, and the court actually asked the counsel to disavow any claim to trademark protection for the letters DWG when they were used as a file extension. And the lawyer for Autodesk did disavow this claim, but then he went ahead and said that, we can still use the letters as a word mark on packaging and advertising and marketing, even if we can't trademark the file extension per se. This disavowal turned out a little differently in the order language, where it said that anyone in the world is free to use the DWG as a file extension as far as Autodesk is concerned. So it seems like this is one of those cases where a judge will sort of talk a lawyer into giving it more ground than they might perhaps want to, or will interpret a lawyer's words differently than a lawyer might want.
Right, but at the same time, if there's no trademark in the file name as it appears on the computer, and your, you know, the this opposing company, the competitor, was saying, you know, our program reads .dwg files. That's descriptive fair use, even if you do have a trademark in it. You know, I can say that, you know, my printer is compatible with HP Ink, even if HP doesn't, you know, endorse my printer. It's I don't think Autodesk's argument was probably weaker on that point, on the descriptive fair use, or nominative fair use, I guess, than it was on the trademark and the file name itself.
Well, what they did after they saw the court's order is they filed another motion and asked the court to reconsider their holding, basically saying that what they really meant was that anyone could use the extension as long as they use the extension with Autodesk's technology or interoperably with that technology, so that they could avoid that bad PDF example that you gave us at the start.
Right, and that, I don't, I mean, there are problems with this anyway, but that seems m slightly more reasonable, a more reasonable position that they can always exert a trademark over that. You know, you can't say we're compatible with .dwgs when your program doesn't actually read a .dwg as it's known in the field. But at that point, you'd have false advertising claims, so I don't really know why you need the trademark portion of the Lanham Act when you could just rely on other portions of it.
Anything else on this story, Dave?
No, not in particular. I think we've kind of covered a lot of our bases here.
Right, then let's move on, unless Ben has something else to add.
No, I was just going to say that I was all set too.
All right, let's move on to our next story, which is the appeal from Aaron and Christine Boring. That is actually their last name. I think we covered this story a couple of months ago.
I don't think so. I'd be really surprised.
Maybe it was before we started our podcast, actually.
It was, as a matter of fact, this occurred back in 2008.
So
Yeah,
let's give.
it was filed January. Yeah, it was filed, yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, so Google has this feature called Street View, which you can see if you go to their Google Maps product, and it'll let you basically zoom in and see what things would like, the view that things would be, the view of things from the street, as you would imagine with a product called Street View. There's another discussion there to decide whether they could trademark that or whether it's purely descriptive. But in any case, they went to Western Pennsylvania with their little roving trucks with the video camera or the cameras on top taking pictures, and they eventually came across the residence of Aaron and Christine Boring, and this Boring residence, it turned out not to be boring at all, as they took pictures, and then Aaron and Christine asked Google to remove the pictures, and Google did so, and then the Borings sued Google, saying that they had trespassed and they had invaded their privacy. And what happened is the district court dismissed the lawsuit, but the Borings appealed, and it turned out just now the Third Circuit Court of Appeals said that the Borings do have the district court was wrong to dismiss the trespass claim, but for everything else, the district court was correct to dismiss. And the Borings now have a chance to go to court to try to win $1 in nominal damages if they can't prove any damages of trespass. So I guess the first issue to talk about here is what did they allege? What were the causes of action? What were they suing Google for?
It was trespass and invasion of privacy primarily, and their case was sort of predicated on this little fact that apparently on the road that they live off of, there was a sign that said "private property, no trespassing." And when you have private property and you have someone who is unauthorized and sort of crosses that property line, you have basically committed trespass at that point. There's other ways you could do it too, but we don't need to get into them. So if you're operating one of these Google cars or trucks, which have these 360-degree or some odd degree number of cameras, there's pan out all around. It's entirely possible that you could have someone that goes onto property which is not public property, and is able to take very close pictures within those property boundaries, and then put them up on the internet. But the funny thing is, I'm not entirely familiar with the map because this case was a long time ago, and I should have gone back and looked at the maps themselves of where they claimed that the private road stopped and started, and where the public road was, and whether or not if you were operating one of these Google trucks, from the public road, if you could see pretty much the exact same thing that you would have seen if you had crossed over and taken the path that the truck actually took, or at least the path that the borings claim it took onto their private property.
I mean, that's an interesting point, but it really only goes to whether or not there was invasion of privacy and not whether or not there is trespass. If the truck clearly went onto their property, which from what I understand was uncontested, then there was trespass. It doesn't matter whether or not, you know, what they saw. For just the trespass claim, the only relevant fact is whether or not the truck went onto their property. And in this case, I think it did.
You still have the issue of damages, though, right, with the trespass?
Right. So if there's just a trespass, and the district court the appeals court here seems to think that that's just what happened, you know, the truck drove up their driveway when they probably shouldn't have, you get what are called nominal damages. You know, if that's all that happened, you get a dollar. And, you know, they can try to, the borings could have tried to get punitive damages, but the judge kind of, the court shut them down on that path because there was nothing, you know, extreme or outrageous about the conduct. If you want additional damages for trespass, compensatory damages in addition to those nominal damages, you have to prove that in this case, Google caused some sort of harm to the property. You know, they ran over a flower pot or they, you know, crushed your mailbox. That would be compensatory damages in addition to just the damages that you get for trespass. But, you know, here the court doesn't seem convinced that much else has happened, but they're going to give the borings a chance to prove that it did.
So there's something, like, really ironic about this case just because, you know, Google Street View is, you know, it's surprising how close in that you can get if you go onto Google Maps and check out the street view in some areas. You can usually zoom in pretty close into, you know, certain private property areas from the public streets where it's normally filmed. And I just have to think that this was such, like, an out-of-the-way place in Pennsylvania, if I'm remembering the maps correctly, that I can't imagine that a whole lot of the general public out there would have been really interested in checking out the Borings' house. And in filing this suit, and it just doesn't strike me as that there are a whole lot of damages, or at least there wasn't a whole lot of harm that had been committed up until the point that the suit was filed. And they've got this sort of unfortunate last name, which just attracted more attention. And once they filed the suit and people started reporting on it, you better believe that there were websites that popped up and they had taken cached images of the Borings' house that were taken from the street view, and they posted them on the web on other websites and reported on the story and stuff. And so it just brought a whole lot more attention probably than they were looking for, and yet they're still duking this thing out in court and claiming that there are some sort of damages that really occurred, when it seems to me like a lot of the damage, or at least a lot of the harm that would have bothered me, occurred after the fact that they filed the suit.
Yeah, they really got hit hard by this Streisand effect, which is, I think we've mentioned this before, it's when you file a suit in order to stop a certain conduct, but in doing so, bring much more attention to it. I want to touch on a couple of the other claims that they brought, and the district court below dismissed them, and then the dismissal was affirmed in the appeals court. And the Borings also said that, in addition to the trespass claims, said that Google invaded their privacy. And in this case, that included specifically intrusion upon seclusion and right of publicity. Now, in this case, the court essentially said neither of those are viable claims here. So intrusion on seclusion, there actually has to be some intrusion on, you know, your right to be secluded. In this case, there were pictures of the outside of their house. There are no pictures of the actual people. And the court at one point went so far as to say, you know, this was less intrusive than somebody walking up to their door and knocking on it. You can't really claim that there are any damages for intrusion on seclusion here. Specifically citing law that says, you know, it has to be highly offensive, you know, the intrusion that occurs. So the second part is publicity given to a private life, and the elements of that, as the court states them, are you have to give some publicity to private facts, which would be highly offensive to a reasonable person, and it's not a legitimate concern to the public. And the court, just like they said in the intrusion on seclusion, said that, you know, this was not highly offensive. And at the very addition to not being highly offensive, you know, pictures of the outside of the house, I don't think they proved much, if anything, about whether or not there were private facts that were revealed about them, other than, you know, maybe there were a pool behind their house that people didn't know about. So both of those claims fell flat. There's one other claim that was also dismissed that was unjust enrichment. Do one of you two want to pick up that for a second and see what tell us a little bit what that's about?
Sure. So basically, unjust enrichment is it's a claim that the plaintiff will bring to say that, hey, in this case, the Borings would allege that Google is making money or some other benefits based on something that the Borings have that Google didn't pay for and that they're unjustly being enriched. So in this case, for example, perhaps they would allege that Google is being unjustly enriched by having these photos of the Borings' house on their website. The court actually dismissed this in the district court, saying that the Borings didn't give anything of value to Google. And in Pennsylvania, unjust enrichment isn't a standalone tort. You have to allege another tort along with it. The appellate court said that they agreed with the district court that there was no basis for an unjust enrichment claim against Google. And that the Borings had never alleged any particular benefit that Google had allegedly unjustly been enriched by. They just said there's unjust enrichment, but didn't say what was the benefit that was being enriched. In other
Right, the
words,
other
Google didn't
thing,
take anything.
right, the other thing is unjust enrichment is typically either a contract or a quasi-contract claim. It's when there was either an actual contract or something that kind of looked like a contract but wasn't quite, then courts will sometimes step in and do this. But there's clearly no contract here. It was Google coming onto their property, allegedly coming onto their property and taking pictures. There's no promise for promise that you typically want to see in a contract.
And it's worth noting that Google has long since taken down the photos of the Borings' house. In fact, it's their standing policy with Street View that if someone requests for the photos to be taken down, they are taken down.
And while we were chatting, I went on the trademark search engine, and Google has not registered a trademark for Street View.
I see. It's probably too descriptive to even try.
I think you mean it's too boring.
Wow.
Sorry, I had to plug that in there.
So the only claim that the appellate court actually said that the district court erred on was the trespass claim. Why did they say that they might have a valid case of trespass against Google?
As we were mentioning before, it's because to get a valid claim about trespass, all you need to do is say that somebody came onto your property, and then you get a dollar's worth of damages. I'm not entirely sure what the district court was doing when they tried to dismiss the claim. They were saying that, you know, the damages that the Borings were alleging were not weren't caused by the trespass. They were caused by, you know, some other thing, by the cameras, by the intrusion on seclusion. But that really isn't an issue, as we were saying, with trespass. The issue with trespass is whether or not they entered the property, and then whether or not, in addition to entering the property, there were other damages. So in this case, there was entry on the property.
Right. I think if I remember correctly, the district court, it was really a procedural matter because the Borings had not actually pleaded for, in their pleadings, they had not asked for nominal damages at all. And that was my understanding of why they had dismissed it under like a 12b6 motion to dismiss.
Okay, that makes sense.
So all that really means, just to explain really quick, is that you always, it's kind of silly the level of detail you have to get into when you're doing certain types of court filings. And one of those things is when you file a complaint, which is the first document you typically file in a lawsuit, is that you have to explain exactly what happened. You have to lay out all the facts and then lay out your claims as well, what you're suing on, you know, what theories under the law. And then you also have to ask for damages where it's appropriate. And in the case of trespass, one of the required elements of having a trespass claim, which won't be thrown out on a motion to dismiss, is for failure to state a claim, that is. So to complete your claim entirely, you need to ask for damages. And you can ask for a bunch of different types of damages, like we've discussed before on the podcast. That includes, you know, actual damages, punitive damages where those might be applicable. And in the case of something like trespass, you can ask for nominal damages, saying that, well, there wasn't really any harm that was done, but he did still trespass onto my property. What the district court was saying is that there was no actual, there was no n nominal damages which were pleaded in the complaint. So therefore, we're going to dismiss it on a if the or when the the defendants had filed a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim.
All right, anything else on this boring case?
I'm all set.
Yeah, I think we're good. It was exciting enough, though.
All right, our final story this week is Macmillan Books, the publisher, had its ebooks removed from Amazon's Kindle store recently over a price disagreement. Apparently what occurred is Macmillan, which is one of the publishers that Apple signed for the new iPad that came out this week, they asked Amazon to raise the price of books from about $9.99, which is what most Kindle books are, to $15. Amazon disagreed and apparently removed Macmillan's books from the ebook store, which may be because that part of the agreement that Macmillan wants to have now is that they want to sell the ebooks at the same price that hardcovers are, or barring that, they want to delay their appearance for several months, sort of like the old way the publishing industry would work, which still works for most books, is that you'd have a hardcover release and then you'd wait some time and then you'd have the paperback release at a lower price. You couldn't get the paperback earlier. This way they could basically price discriminate, and people who really want to read the book right away will pay that amount of money for the hardcover. Ebooks sort of went around this because if you had a Kindle ebook reader, you could get the book right away for the lower price, theoretically, because I mean there's no cost in producing the ebook because there's no binding, it's all electronic. But publishers being publishers, they didn't like this arrangement. Apple gives them more freedom in pricing their books on the iPad and the ebook or the iBook store. And so Apple or Amazon actually removed the books here. Ben, do you have, you've studied this story a bit more. Is there more you can elucidate us with?
Yeah, it's, the more I read about this, the more I'm siding a little more with Macmillan over Amazon. So the last I've heard from Macmillan's side of this story was that they don't want to necessarily wait until, you know, they don't want to necessarily delay the release of books. What they want to do is have more flexibility in pricing, where they'd have ideally a price spectrum that went from about $6 to $15, and it would be $15, you know, at a concurrent or at a release date very close to the release date of the hardcover. And then when the trade paperback came out, they would reduce the ebook price, and when the paperback came out, they'd reduce the ebook price again down to that floor where the ebook is still slightly less than the trade paperback than the mass market paperback. The mass market paperbacks are the really flimsy one. The trade paperbacks are slightly larger, a little more sturdy, and that strikes me as very fair. My initial reaction was it seems like a bad idea to charge nearly as much for the book in electronic form with DRM as Amazon charges for the hardcover without DRM, because the music industry didn't do very well when they were charging, you know, substantially the same price for a DRM'd electronic file as they were for a CD, because it just doesn't make any sense to buy the DRM'd electronic file at that point. Here, you know, Macmillan has a good point. There should be some flexibility in the pricing of these, because price discrimination, where you charge, you know, early readers a higher price than people who are willing to wait, it's frankly good for capitalism. It allows Macmillan to get the most out of their customers, and it allows the customers who are willing to pay more and get that book up front to, you know, be happy with that, as opposed to, you know, if Amazon were to demand that it be sold for $10, you know, Macmillan may wait until after the trade paperback came out before they released it at that price point.
I mean, it's great to note here that Macmillan was put in a pretty good leveraging position, and maybe they just didn't expect Amazon to take the action that they ended up taking when the iPad was released this week. And that's because up to this point, as far as I know, the Kindle has been probably one of the more successful ebook reader devices out there that's been released to date. That's among, let's say we have the Amazon Kindle, we have, what's it, Barnes & Noble's Nook Reader, and then there's the Sony ebook reader as well, right? And now we have the iPad, and as far as I know, the Nook and the Sony device have sort of not enjoyed as much success as the Kindle has, and so the Kindle has been sort of the dominant ebook reader, at least among all the ones that I've seen in the public. I've seen it more than any of the others. And now we have the iPad, which comes out from Apple, which has a, at least a very recent, in the last decade or so, a very recent strong history of being a, you know, having strong product sales for any devices that they release. You know, if you look back to the iPod, this has been true. If you look back to some of their notebook items, those have also sold pretty well, and they have a good following in that some people are just so dedicated to the brand name that they're willing to buy any devices that the company manufactures or sells. And in this case, maybe Macmillan was thinking, well, look, now we got the iPad out, and some people think it's going to be a really successful device that's going to take the whole ebook reader revolution, if that's what you want to call it, to the next level. And if they're going to have a model which allows me in their iBook store to, or allows Macmillan in their iBook store to set their own prices for certain book releases, then maybe they could use that to leverage Amazon a little bit in order to up the price of the book and hopefully get more revenue out of it. But it looks like Amazon just wasn't really willing to play ball with that here.
Yeah, I think Amazon thinks that, I mean, Amazon still has a, not an actual monopoly, but a virtual monopoly on ebook sales for the next 2 months until the iPad actually is released, as opposed to, you know, last week when it was announced. And in fact, Amazon last week announced that they were, starting in June, they were going to have a new pricing scheme where, and I'm going to try to recite this from memory because I don't even know if I have a, if I can pull it up quickly, but essentially it was, if you agree not to charge more than $9.99 for your book, for your ebook, and agree that the price will be less than any, you know, dead tree where book that Amazon, version of the book that Amazon sells, then we will split the, we'll do a 70-30 split with you, where the publisher gets 70% and the, and Amazon gets 30% of the sales, which is very similar to Apple's pricing scheme on both music and apps. I don't know if they announced what the pricing scheme was on, what the split scheme, rather, was for books, but it's a fair assumption that it's going to be 70% to the publisher and 30% to Apple. Now, one of you was going to say something?
Yeah, no, just that it's pretty clear to me that, I mean, there was a lot of hype around the release of the iPad, and people have been talking about this for 10 years, and so I am willing to bet that Amazon is at least a little bit uncomfortable with the fact that Apple's going to come out with a, or is, has released and announced now a device that is going to be competing in the same market that the Kindle has.
Yeah, that being said, I'm not, I haven't played with it, so I don't really know, you know, how well it works. But my worries about it for, as an ebook reader are the fact that it seems to be larger than the Kindle, and I don't know if it's going to be particularly easy to operate one-handed like the Kindle is. And, you know, those are big selling points for me.
So there is two models of the Kindle out there. There's the Kindle 2 and then the Kindle DX. And as far as I know, the iPad is pretty, it's the Kindle DX is a little bit larger than the Kindle 2. And I don't know what the actual dimensions are, but suffice it to say, it's probably pretty close to what the sizing of a netbook. So probably, what, 10 inches diagonally across? And
the DX is like 9.7, I think.
Okay, yeah, so pretty close.
For the screen, days. And then a little more for the borders and the keyboard. Oh, yeah, but so, there's... There's one other thing I wanted to mention about Amazon's updated pricing scheme. It includes something that we talked about last week or the week before, which is a most favored nations clause that says, in addition to all of those other restrictions that we're putting on, you know, the how you can price your ebook, you can't price it lower at any other ebook store than at the Amazon store. So, you know, you will muse about, although not in depth, what the antitrust implications are of saying, you know, putting all those restrictions on and then saying, but and you have to give us the best price out of all of the people or equal to the best price that you're offering everybody else.
Right, so that's a great point. So, I mean, the, a legal concern is certainly that if you're Amazon and you're thinking about what the potential legal implications might be, if you start engaging in conduct like that through contracts specifically, where you have it written down on paper, it might amount to a restraint on trade, which under the Sherman Act, if I'm quoting that correctly, Section 1 of the Sherman Act, is an anti-competitive practice if they do in fact gain monopoly power over this particular market. That said, I don't know that they necessarily have it. I think the date, no one's actually seen the numbers as far as I know for how many Kindle devices have been sold, but I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of like between 1 and 2 million. So it's not like an obscene amount of devices. But it
Amazon
is,
hasn't
as far
released
as I know.
The number.
Yeah. It's. I think it's just estimated by reports to be somewhere in that neighborhood. But like I said earlier, I think it's the more dominant of the three devices that are out, or the four devices that will be out, including the iPad.
Yeah. On a side note, I feel really bad for Sony because Sony's had an e-reader out on the market for probably 5 or 6 years, and I remember, playing with them years ago and thinking that it was the coolest thing in the world, but at the time it was very expensive. I think it was almost $500. So, they've been out there, they've had a store, they've been updating it with ebooks all of this time, and then Amazon comes in and blows them out of the water with what wasn't a particularly better product. I think it was just better marketed and it had the Amazon name behind it as opposed to the Sony name, which no one associates with books at all.
Yeah. The thing about the Apple iPad, though, it's not an e-ink screen, though. It's just a standard LCD, right? So it's light emitting, it's not light absorbing.
LCDs aren't light emitting. There's an LED backlight, but the LCD itself, it's a nitpick. Never mind. Yes. So the downside is
light comes out of the screen.
Yeah.
Right into your eyes.
It's harsher on the eyes than the e-ink screen is. And, Kindles can go weeks without charging. I mean, you can only go a couple of thousand page turns without charging. But, they'll last a lot longer between charges. On the flip side of that, you're probably going to, if you're using your iPad, you're probably going to be charging it every day or every other day anyway. So it probably doesn't matter that much if you're using it like that.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen the screen up close of what the Kindle looks like, it's pretty close to what the old Etch-a-Sketch looked like in terms of the way that things are displayed. There's no light that shines into your eyes as if you've been staring at a computer monitor for hours on end after you're reading, which is tough to do. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel, but after an hour or two of reading things on the computer, my eyes really start to get strained, and I need to go turn my head somewhere else and do something on hard paper before I can go back to them.
Yeah.
And in contrast, when I read on my Kindle, I don't feel any eye strain at all. It's like a book or even faster.
Yeah, the only downside that I have to the Kindle is that the anti-aliasing. For a screen of that resolution, the letters are a little more blocky than I would like them to be. I don't know if the Kindle 2 is better than... I have the Kindle 1, but... The screen, while it's very good, it just doesn't have that same feel that, really crisply rendered text on a computer screen or in a book would have.
I haven't encountered that issue with Kindle 2.
So anyways, getting back to the story, since we're not exactly a product review podcast, I'm going to speculate
a
little bit
here. The iPad
came
out this week. We had to talk about it.
I know. I'm sure you guys were following it closely on all of the blogs as the conference went on. I know my eyes were certainly glued to the screen trying to figure out what everyone thought about it. Anyways, I'm going to speculate a little bit. So if the iPad is as successful as some people think that it will be, or as Apple hopes it will be, Amazon might, just from a business standpoint, might have to take into account changing its pricing scheme and allowing people to, or publishing companies to set their prices a little bit different. They're got to worry about being as to continue to be as successful as they have been with their readers. And so it might just sort of force them or leverage them a little bit into adopting a different pricing scheme, whether that's the one that they're reportedly going to change to in the future or not. Way too hard to say, but aside from all the contract issues which might be available in between Amazon and any of the publishers which currently do release books to the Kindle, that might not be enough, and it could just be pure business reasons which force them to change the model.
Yeah, one thing that I think is also going to be interesting to keep an eye on is whether or not the DRM will drop off of ebooks like it has off of MP3s. But on the flip side, like it has not from apps and movies and TV shows. And I don't know exactly why that is. Why there's still DRM attached to TV shows and movies, but the DRM has fallen off of music. I mean, well, one of the reasons why it fell off of music is to allow for competitors. So the iPod was so dominant in the market that in order to compete with selling music online, they had to music companies had to take DRM off of it. I wonder if there will ever be a context where one ebook reader is so dominant that they have to that publishers have to drop the DRM in order to compete properly.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, if you're not familiar with DRM, it's just a little bit of technology which is attached to content, which controls access to the content itself. So, if it used to be the case that if you bought songs through iTunes, and it still is, I think, for some of the songs you get on iTunes, you can only use it on your iPod device or on your authorized computers or authorized iPods that you have. But you couldn't, for instance, just copy that file over to a friend and say, "Here, check out the song. It's great." Or, "Here's a copy of the song." So in some ways it prohibits the copyright infringement, but the problem is, historically and within the Copyright Act itself, we have this little provision under section, I think it's 109 or 107, called the First Sale Doctrine, and that has created the secondary market which we've enjoyed for so many years, where after you're done reading a book, you can go off and sell it to another person, and the copyright holder or the owner of the book or the person who wrote it, wherever those rights might lie, does not have any legal rights to stop you from selling it to another person. Now, that's completely changed as we moved into digital content because DRM has so effectively allowed people to maintain control over how and where people can use the content that they purchase. And my personal opinion is that because of the success of the iPod, really, it was fast to be adopted almost by everybody, and I know very few people these days that have not owned an iPod or do not currently own an iPod or at some point in their lives. And it just I think that people weren't quite as aware of the DRM and how restrictive it was, but it was a great business model because it forced people to stick within if they got an iPod, they were essentially forced to keep the iPod just in order to be able to enjoy their music collections that they purchased over iTunes. And similarly, I think that's going to apply here in this case. And I guarantee you that the publishers really want DRM to stay on the ebook files themselves and prohibit people from being able, after they finish reading an ebook, to pass it off to somebody else. It sort of really defeats the model quickly. And I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it will just depend on the reaction of people as they realize that their ebooks are pretty much handcuffed to the devices that they have, or maybe they're just handcuffed to their computers or something, which they purchased the files on themselves. But at least at present, it doesn't show very many signs of the publishers wanting to go to a non-DRM model.
That makes sense. I personally think it will be interesting to see whether Apple will block the Kindle app from appearing on the iPad.
My question is whether or not Apple's going to release an iBooks app for the desktop and for the iPod. Because if I'm going to have an Apple product that reads books, I'd like to be able to read that book on all of my Apple products. I mean, ideally, I'd like to be able to read that book on all of my devices, on my desktop, on my iPhone, if I get an iPad, on my iPad, and on my Kindle, but that's not going to happen anytime soon, so.
The Kindle actually lets you read it on your PC, on your Mac, on your iPhone.
Yes, which is nice.
So, anyway, anything else on this story?
I'm all set, David.
I think we're good.
Right then, well, thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please visit our website at www.technicallylegal.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @TechLegal, and if you have any questions or comments or ideas for our podcast, please feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Signing out, I'm Dominic Ramier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to GDGT Podcast. I'm Ryan Block.
I'm Peter Rosas, right?
Rowhouse.
What the frack?
Rowhouse. Wow, one of those. I knew it.
Because we were doing a review of the Kindle and the iPad.
Ah.